Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to ScaryCast, the special tonight. We are having a special broadcast of ScaryCast that revolves around the Aurora, Texas UFO crash of 1897. Today, April 17th, is the 100th anniversary of that famed UFO crash. And truly, other than Roswell, this is my favorite UFO story of all time because it is so well documented. It has had interviews with people. And I just love this. I think it's wonderful. So first of all, I'd like to introduce our co-hosts. First, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast, who was with us all weekend at Georgia Bigfoot Conference, Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing tonight? Have you recovered from the Georgia Bigfoot experience?
Oh, John, there was nothing to recover from. It was a fun weekend, and you had a great crowd. And now that the COVID is showing us the end of it, it really was wonderful to have an opportunity to have a group of people in the public come and gather and listen to a wide variety of speakers and have great conversations. I think that's probably one of the best takeaways for attending a conference like this. It's not like us on the radio, although we were on a podcast yesterday of sorts, but it was really nice to be able to have interactions with individuals.
Well, it really was, and we had yesterday among my very special friends, Robin McCray, a co-host of ScaryCast. She's a bit under the weather, so she won't be with us tonight. We had Sonia Thompson, the main lady zombie of all time from The Walking Dead. We love Sonia Thompson. In fact, Sonia and I talked 30 minutes this morning. She had such a great time. And we also had Kevin Holland of The Walking Dead. He came up to help and made a very favorable impression on a lot of people. So it's great to have our friends from The Walking Dead, you and Robin. I mean, y'all are absolutely the closest friends that I've got, and I want to say thanks to you and Robin and Sonia and Kevin for being with us. I know they're going to listen to this podcast, so I can't say enough nice things about you great people. So again, thanks for being there. It was a real privilege to get to hang out with you, and we had a lot of fun. Now, other co-hosts tonight include from Pop Culture Stars. He's been with the ScaryCast Pop Culture Stars family for 4 years. Our guy from the northernmost outpost in Indianapolis, Indiana, Todd Saxon. How are you doing tonight, Todd?
I'm doing outstanding, the supernatural, and ecstatic to be here on this most auspicious of occasions, gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much. We are glad to have you. You have a very inquisitive mind, and that's why you are asked. So we're glad to have you. And we have a new guy to the ScaryCast family from Houston, Texas. And I got to say this. When I call and talk to him about the paranormal, he has yet to tell me to hang up. So he gets an A-plus for that. From Houston, Texas, it's Kyler Smith. Good evening, Kyler. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I hope you guys are excited to have an amazing podcast because I'm so excited right now.
Well, I am too. I've been looking forward to this. This is second only to the Georgia Bigfoot Conference because that thing took days and days and days to prepare. And again, yesterday on April the 16th, we had it, and it was great, and it was a lot of fun. But I certainly promoted this thing tonight. And by the way, this past Friday, I took part in a podcast with the Wise County Messenger about our podcast tonight, and I hope we'll have some listeners from Wise County and from Texas, so it's going to be a lot of fun. So anyway, our guest tonight is a man who has written a number of articles about UFOs in Texas, and especially he's got the great researched story about the Aurora 1897 UFO crash. The one, the only, our buddy from Roswell, New Mexico, the king spot of all UFO crash sites, John LeMay. How are you doing tonight, John?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's always good to be on ScaryCast, so I'm ready.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks very much. what I'd like for you to do is you have a chapter in your book, The Coming of the Airships, about a couple of crashes prior to Aurora. And then you have that great, well-documented chapter about the Aurora UFO crash. So I'd like for you to spend a little bit of time talking about the other crashes that came about, and then the great Aurora UFO crash, and then we're going to go around to our co-host and ask you some questions and have our usual scary cast good time. So, John, the floor is yours.
Well, I just want to say Aurora, Texas, and its crash is just a really cool story. And it's a lot like Roswell in the sense that, you know, to the general public, they think Roswell's the only place a UFO ever crashed. Well, UFOs crashed long before ever hitting Roswell. I think there was a UFO crash somewhere in, like, Missouri in 1943, Cape Girardeau, Missouri, or something like that. You know, it just wasn't as publicized as Roswell. There were UFO crashes 41, after 41 Roswell.
41 or 42, maybe.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, I could not remember the year, but I know I remember the name of it. At least Cape Girardeau.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and then, like, there was one right after Roswell, too, in Aztec, New Mexico. But Roswell, you know, is the one that gets all the attention. And Aurora is like that for the Old West. There was actually a lot of UFO sightings in the Old West and even airship crashes. But Aurora is just the best documented, and it has other similarities to Roswell we'll get into later. But 1896 to 1897, there was just this huge they called it the airship wave because back then, you know, they didn't have the term UFO yet, so they just called them airships. And 1896 was fairly busy, but 1897 was the really busy one, and especially April of 1897. And I don't mean like April 1st. I just mean like all throughout April, there were tons of airship sightings. And I have a bunch of them right here in front of me. I'm just going to go over briefly. Let me see here, because I'm telling you, April was just packed. So actually, April is when the 1897 wave began, now that I'm looking at it. So I think the first one was in Rogers Park, Illinois, on April 13th. Then the next one occurred that we know of. Same day, April 13th, St. Paul, Minnesota, there was another one. But what John's interested in is these two airship crashes that happened just, on April 11th, there was an airship crash in Iowa Falls, Iowa. And then on April 14th, there was one in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So I'll read some of the accounts. Actually, what's ironic is the Dallas Morning News is who broke one of these stories, which also broke Aurora. So let me see. I'm going to pull it up and we'll read some of it. So the story begins, if reports be true, the airship, that ghost-like and meteoric wanderer through the realms of the western sky, which has started and awed the mighty west for several months, is now a thing of the glorious past. The dull thud it did when it came down, it was seen and it blew up, so the report says. And just to intercede, you know, back then they talked like there was only one airship, you know, because they saw it, they call it the airship, but obviously there were lots of them. The two witnesses were named George W. Summers and William Chadburn. They were a couple of old soldiers, and the paper reported that they remained up all night until very late hours. They were working on a sick horse. And the descriptions they gave of the airship are, as the paper says, somewhat at a variance, though they agree in the assertion that the craft illuminated at both ends and moved through space with wonderful rapidity. The men had scarcely time for a glimpse of the flying machine when a dull explosion was heard and the craft disappeared. They declare the report was like that of a heavy cannon and was immediately followed flying through the air. Wondering greatly and sad at heart at the inglorious end of the Pride of the West, the two men proceeded to the house, where they passed an excited and sleepless night. While Summers and Chadburn are the only ones who witnessed the dying agonies of the airy visitor, there are many corroboratory circumstances. Mr. and Mrs. Wallace, who lived nearby, say they heard the explosion distinctly but thought it was thunder. And that definitely brings to mind the Roswell UFO crash, where the witness at that time also thought it was thunder. And they found some wreckage. The paper reports, then the discoveries of the morning go a long way towards establishing the veracity of the two actual observers of the explosion. In one place, 2 miles from Scott's, there was found a large coil of heavy wire, evidently a part of some electric appliance. At another point, a propeller blade of some very light material was discovered in a partially fused condition. 3 men engaged in shingling a barn in Comstock Township affirmed that upon resuming work on the morning following, they found the house covered with minute fragments of steel, which had in some instances penetrated the shingles and entered the boards beneath. And there's actually more to it than that. The next night, another distressed airship was sighted. So I guess from this you could actually kind of theorize that maybe that first airship didn't crash. It just kind of exploded and kind of went on its way. Let's see. And then there's also a report that a farmer who resided 5 miles northeast of that same area found the wheel of the alleged airship as well. And let's see, George Parks of Pennefield and his wife were crossing a field when their attention was drawn to a very bright object that appeared to be about 100 feet from the earth and swiftly approaching. Mr. Parks thought from its light and the humming sound it made that it was a meteor. As it passed over them, a little to their left, a part of it fell to the earth and buried itself in the ground. Mrs. Parks, who was somewhat frightened, would not let her husband go near where it fell. The next morning, Mr. Parks and his brother Benjamin dug it up and found it to be a large wheel made of aluminum, about 3 feet in diameter, and a turbine in shape. Mr. Parks says it is the first time he ever heard of a meteor having wheels. He will keep the wheel as a memento, and it may be seen at any time at his farm in Pennefield. And, of course, today, you know, nobody knows where this wreckage went, which it would be very interesting, obviously, to test it, but you know, they probably didn't think anything of it. Once the story was over, it got put in somebody's attic and just kind of lost. So who knows where it is today. And apparently, that's the account of the airship from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
And this is 1897.
Yep, same, just a few days before Aurora. Yeah, 1897.
And, you know, it's interesting that they try to identify these parts with what they know. But just because it was round, they put some terminology with it, but who knows what it was, you know? And that's very interesting. I mean, those are great accounts, John, because
yeah.
It lets us know that now it seems as though we have not had any UFO crashes in recent memory, like since 2000, or have we? I mean, do you know of any, or do any of our co-hosts know of any UFO crashes since, say, 2000? I don't.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't know of any crashes, no.
The only thing I've got one
comment on that. They claim the metal was aluminum. And aluminum wasn't in widespread use in 1897. It was actually incorporated into crown jewels of Europe. So aluminum was a precious object. When the top of the Washington Monument was built, the pinnacle at the very top is aluminum. And it was in the Tiffany jewelry store window in New York. And I don't remember when that was, but aluminum was pretty rare. And in looking at just a quick search for aluminum, first industrial production of aluminum was in France in 1856. And then later on, it became more available to the public when they came up with a French and an American engineer in 1886. So aluminum would be pretty new metal to be seen at that time. So it's interesting they recognize it as aluminum. And I would imagine it probably wasn't just aluminum. It could have been an alloy if it was truly an alien vessel. I don't think they'd be using simple aluminum. But it's interesting how they called it aluminum. And that might be because that was an important metal at that time. That was something that would be a topic of conversation 10 years after this way to create aluminum cheaper. Just an observation.
That's a good observation, Trey. It really is. John, do you agree with that?
Yeah, that actually stuck out to me, too, the thing about the aluminum. I'm just not as smart as Trey to put all that into words and find it, so I'm glad he said something.
Right,
yeah,
because in Aurora, they used the word aluminum as well, and silver.
Yes, and I think even in Roswell at one time they compared it to aluminum, but I'm just kind of going off my memory. But so I think
now Roswell, aluminum was common at the time of Roswell.
Yeah,
I mean it was readily made and manufactured aircraft parts, all this stuff. So but this is 1897, and the process of aluminum was just in its nascency at that time. So that's interesting that they would call it aluminum in 1897. I wonder how much experience the average person would have to be able to identify aluminum. Today, certainly, no problem. Everybody knows what aluminum is. But 125 years ago, I don't know if they'd be so quick to identify aluminum as a free metal. Just a thought.
Absolutely. That's a great thought. Well, anyway, John, I guess it's time, because it's the 125th anniversary, could you detail the great Aurora crash? And then I know all Todd and Tyler and, of course, Trey will have some questions for you. So do you mind? Let's get on to the most important part of this broadcast, which is the great UFO crash of 1897.
Oh, yeah, and I do just want to mention there was, again, like a few days before Aurora, they weren't crashes, but, like, there was a lot of airship sightings. There was a big one over Paris, Texas on the 14th. On April 16th, this is too interesting to pass up, I just have to mention, in Springfield, Missouri, an airship, and the guy that saw him compared him to Adam and Eve because he just thought they were, like, such perfect people. So you've got a sighting of some naked humanoid aliens in Springfield, Missouri. There was a big giant alien the day before the Aurora crash, April 16th, in Reynolds, Michigan, where they sighted a giant humanoid emerge from an airship. And he actually, if I remember right, he kicked a farmer. It's kind of an odd story. But then, okay, now we come to April 17th with the Aurora UFO crash, and I'll read the original article so that way I don't paraphrase anything, and this is the information exactly as it was in the Dallas Morning News. It goes that about 6 o'clock this morning, the early risers of Aurora were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship, which has been sailing through the country. It was traveling due north and much nearer the Earth than ever before. Evidently, some of the machinery was out of order, for it was making a speed of only 10 or 12 miles an hour, and gradually settling toward the Earth. It sailed directly over the public square, and when it reached the north part of town, collided with the tower of Judge Proctor's windmill and went to pieces with a terrific explosion, scattering debris over several acres of ground, wrecking the windmill and water tank, and destroying the judge's flower garden. And then this is where it gets interesting. It says the pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board. And while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. Mr. T.J. Weems, the United States Signal Service officer at this place and an authority on astronomy, gives it as his opinion that he was a native of the planet Mars. papers found on his person, evidently the record of his travels, and written in some unknown hieroglyphics, and cannot be deciphered. The ship was too badly wrecked to form any conclusion as to its construction or motive of power. It was built of an unknown metal, resembling somewhat a mixture of aluminum and silver, and it must have weighed several tons. The town is full of people today who are viewing the wreck and gathering specimens of the strange metal from the debris. The pilot's funeral will take place at noon tomorrow. And that's where the article ends. It says it's by S.E. Hayden. And according to a Texas State Historical Marker, this funeral really did take place. They really did bury an alien. And I'll talk just for a second about that because I have the text of the marker right here. Let me see here where it talks about the alien. Where is that? Okay. So on an official state historical marker at the Aurora Cemetery, says this site is also well known because of the legend that a spaceship crashed nearby in 1897 and the pilot killed in the crash was buried here. So, I mean, that's on an actual state marker. And there was a tombstone for a while at the cemetery, which was unfortunately stolen. But let's see, I think it was Bill Case, the state director of MUFON. He went and investigated it in 1973, and he saw the tombstone. He said it had like a UFO with portholes in it scrawled on it. But when he went back another time to go look at it again, it was gone. And he brought a metal detector with him, and he used it over the spot where the alien was allegedly buried, and he got some strong metal readings, but, you know, no one would let him exhume the grave and get down under there naturally. And today Aurora, you know, that's kind of like Roswell. It's the main thing that they promote. On the sign for their visitor center, they have a UFO on it. So it's just like Roswell, but from the Old West and just a little bit smaller.
Okay. So they certainly acknowledge that they had a UFO crash, and they're very proud of it because from what I understand, in 2016, they had a major conference with a number of UFO types, including Travis Walton, Nick Redfern, Noe Torres, your partner in writing these wonderful books and everything else. Did you happen to get to go to that conference, John, or did you get to learn about it secondhand?
No, I just learned about it secondhand, unfortunately. So,
okay. Well, we've got the absolute beginnings of a great adventure, and I'd like to turn it over to our panelists to ask you some questions. I'm gonna go with Todd first, and then Dr. Trey, and then Kyler, and then we'll go back around. So, Todd, do you have a question for John LeMay about the great UFO crash of 1897?
Yeah, not the crash directly, but the follow-up. You referenced MUFON coming out in 73 and trying to look at that, and they did request to have the grave exhumed. If I'm tracking, and it was kind of interesting that the night that the permission was denied, there was an event at the grave. That they went back the next day and the grave had apparently been robbed. Have you tracking, aware of any of that, John?
Yeah, I think it's funny because stealing Old West tombstones is pretty common. Like Billy the Kid had his tombstone stolen like several times. So I think it's interesting that this alleged alien also had their tombstone stolen. And don't think it's ever been returned.
No, and I'm not talking the tombstone. I'm talking the grave itself was robbed.
Oh, okay.
It was exhumed.
Okay. I think I heard that somewhere, but I can't remember.
I had actually picked it up. There was an old MUFON series on that stuff, and they had done an episode on it. And that's where I picked up on that.
You know, I can't help but think from a from mercenary point of view, if a town's claim to fame was the burial site of an alien, they wouldn't want that grave to be dug up because there's no dispute. If it was dug up and then they did not find that, then that would be in dispute, and it might hurt the ability to have people visit the town because there is no grave. But if they made it look like it was a grave robber, then you can't – again, it puts it back to the we don't know rather than we're absolutely sure one way or the other. So I if I was a town father, I think I would probably arrange a group to go in and dig the soil up. You know about the prank that was played in Harvard Yard, don't you? I don't know if it was Harvard Yard. It was in Boston. There's a cannon, a Revolutionary War era cannon, buried in the center of this circle. And one morning, people woke up and they found there was a hole and a pile of dirt, and the cannon was missing. And they pulled out all the stops. They had the state police, they had the FBI, they had the CIA, they had everybody looking for the stolen cannon. And then somebody noticed that the hole was not quite in the center of the circle. And what some prankster did is they dug a hole adjacent to the cannon, took the dirt, covered up the cannon. So I can't help but think maybe somebody dug a hole, maybe not down to the depth of the grave, but just dug a hole to make it appear that whatever might have been there is now removed, so now it will forever be a mystery as to whether or not there was a finding there. And then if you take the gravestone, in time, people will forget exactly where that was unless they put another marker there. So that's just playing devil's advocate.
Maybe they dug and they didn't find anything because they dug at exactly the wrong spot. So let's face it, a priest is a pretty small object. I mean, it's like in general 7 feet long by about 2.5 feet wide. And, you know, you might can miss that when you're digging. You really can.
Yep. But you wouldn't actually have to dig anything up. You just have to make it look like you dug something up. Then it would be missing to history again. And then the mystery would still be there. And this would be the grave of the alien. It might be an empty grave, but it's still the grave of the alien for tourism purposes.
Well, I feel like, too, if it's a small town, if it's a small town and someone actually dug it up and kept it, word gets around pretty quick. So someone would have figured it out.
Right, right.
I mean, this is an amazing, you know, the more we talk about it, it's a really amazing kind of thing. And I will go ahead and share with everybody that the editor and the associate editor of the Wise County Messenger, which is the newspaper for Wise County, where Aurora is, they have invited me down there to give me a tour of the cemetery and to share with me some things that are not necessarily public. And I'm very pleased to say that Kyler is going to be going with me, because why do I have somebody in Houston, Texas? Because he can help me and explore all these great mysteries of
absolutely of
the one and only Aurora, because something makes me want to go there. And I just think it's the most marvelous thing, especially now, John LeMay, I'm going to turn this one back to you. There was a gentleman whose family bought the farm of Judge Proctor, and they developed some very strange, very strange arthritis from drinking the water from the well, where apparently, or it was of legend, that people put the wreckage of the UFO down the well. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's not much more I can add to it other than what you just said, and I can hopefully find the guy's name without killing too much airtime, but yeah, family bought it, I think, in the 1940s, which is cool because it proves that Judge Proctor was real. That's really important with these old cases is, are the people real? And unfortunately, like T.J. Weems, the military guy, I don't think anyone's ever found proof that he existed. You know, I don't think they've ever found records on him. But Judge Proctor, at least, a lot of records for him. I don't know that he was actually a judge either, believe it or not. I've kind of found some things that imply that they just called him Judge, you know, because back then in those days, they might call somebody Major when they were never in the military, you know, just it was kind of just a weird informal title they'd give him. So I don't know for sure that he was a judge. I feel like that still has yet to be confirmed. But, you know, the property proves that Judge Proctor at least was real. And the guy who bought the property, you're exactly right, said there were metal fragments down in the well, and they cleared them out and removed them, and that they used it as their drinking well, and that they just developed extremely unusually bad arthritis, and they had the water tested, and it did show extremely high traces of aluminum in it, is what I remember from memory. But I'll kind of look and see if I can find something more specific than that, though. Okay, all right. Actually, I'm on that, just on that right page. So the current owner, I believe, is named Tim Oates, and his grandfather was named Brawley Oates, and he bought it back in 1945. And that's about it. I don't think we missed anything.
Yep. I remember that story, but this is what just doesn't ring right with me on that particular part. Society was not so dadgum wasteful back then that they would take a chance of throwing random stuff into legit drinking water, because that would have been fairly legit high priority thing, than to take the chance of just fouling that. That's my thoughts on it.
And especially aluminum was valuable. I did find the reference when I get around to me. I'll talk more about the Washington Monument aluminum, but aluminum was valuable. So they wouldn't be chucking aluminum down in a well.
Yeah. Well
they also said that
They also said that this was like several tons. How did they just throw all that away without was it like just completely disappearing?
Yeah, it's fishy.
Yeah, the only other fishy thing I've ever found about Aurora, other than just your basic detractors, is I found Judge Proctor's obituary. And I'm trying to dig it up on my computer here. If I find it, I'll intercede and read it. But Judge Proctor's obituary is kind of interesting from a slightly skeptical point of view. So if I find that, I'll read it to us.
Look for it, because I'm going to tell you what aluminum toxicity is. The symptoms of aluminum toxicity are confusion, muscle weakness, bone pain, deformities, fractures, seizures, speech problems, slow growth in children. Complications may include lung problems, nervous system problems, bone disease, brain disease, disorders, anemia, impaired iron absorption. So, you know, I don't think aluminum could cause bone pain, but it would cause a lot of other problems if it was a toxic level of aluminum.
And that seems like what his grandfather Brawley had. He had severe deformity and arthritis in his hands. Am I correct, John?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I found that obit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I found the obit, and it's Wise County. It's like, so actually I take it back. It's Judge Proctor's wife, Wise County Messenger, May 13th, 1921. It's got her obituary. Old Boyd citizen died on Monday. Mrs. Nancy Elizabeth Skill Proctor, widow of J.S. Proctor, died at 4 o'clock a.m. at her home in Boyd. Monday following a stroke, we don't need to know where she was born and all that. I'm just trying to get to the interesting stuff. Okay. She was married on February 24th, 1859 to J.S. Proctor, and with him and their five children came to Wise County in 1880. It would be interesting to find those children and their descendants. Her husband, this is what troubled me. So we're talking about J.S. Proctor, who the article calls Judge. So this is what it says. Her husband, a former newspaper man, died on September 11th, 1917. I'm a little bit troubled that Judge Proctor is a newspaper man, because it makes me think, what if he wrote that article under the name S.E. Hayden? You know, I think that's a possibility that needs to be looked into and kind of proven one way or the other. But yeah, that always struck me as interesting that he was a newspaper man, but, you know, of course, the original article from the Dallas Morning News didn't say anything about Judge Proctor being a newspaper man. They just kind of let you think he was a judge, but...
Well, what I can tell you about judges of that time were if you were a magistrate, and even today in South Carolina, you don't have to be trained as an attorney to be a magistrate, which is a judge. So it seems totally consistent that he could have been in charge of a courtroom that did low-level crimes and whatever, and he was called judge. So it's not too far-fetched that that could have happened. Because as I said, here in Conway, South Carolina, we've got a judge that's got a PhD in history, and he's a magistrate, and he does what he does. So the title judge might have been conferred on him because of some of the things that he did. That's just a thought.
Well, of course, obviously, if he's a newspaperman, not that we have biased newspapers or newspapers that won't print absolutely the truth, it could have been a slow news week, too, and he decided to sell some papers with a great story.
Maybe
so. You know, human nature, well, human nature is human nature. So what can you...
Well, I'll be honest with you. The real reason that I wanted to do this is I wanted to reopen the case. I think that there's more here than meets the eye. And I know that when Kyler and I go down there to meet with the editor and the associate editor of the Wise County Messenger, we're going to find some things. And John LeMay, I hope that we'll be able to work with you because this, I believe that there's more here than meets the eye. And you got to have some just tenacious sons of bitches, pardon my grammar, that just want to go down there and figure out what is going on here because it's, the story has a greatness about it that most stories don't have. And it seems like, as we've talked about tonight, there are so many loose ends, don't you think, John?
Yeah, and since I went on the skeptical side now, I want to go in the other direction because Aurora is just like Roswell in the sense that you've got witnesses that are credible, that bolster it, and then you've got, detractors that throw a monkey wrench into it. So it's really 50-50, just like Roswell. And, like, here are some people who claim they were children in Aurora in 1897. Of course, they're passed away now, but they were interviewed, probably back in the 70s and the 80s. And one of them was named Tony Wheeler, says they held fond memories of growing up in the rural town of Aurora, sitting on the porch of an elderly resident named Mr. Mayfield and listening to him tell about the time a UFO crashed into a windmill killing a spaceman. And he would tell us it did in fact happen, said Wheeler, now the city administrator, recounting one of the highlights of her Wise County childhood in the 1970s. And this is another quote from Wheeler. And he said tons of people went rushing up there to the crash site, but they made all the kids stay back underneath the hill because they were afraid it being the alien, might have a disease. There are a couple more. Let's see. Two other witnesses were discovered in 1973 by Bill Case, that Texas MUFON guy. One was Mary Evans, whose story matches up pretty well with old man Mayfield. Says Evans was 15 at the time of the crash and claimed that it did in fact happen, but she didn't get to go look at it because her parents forbade her from doing so. And then the other one is Charles Stevens, said he was 10 years old in 1897. He claimed that he saw the airship sailing through the skies and it was, trailing smoke behind it as it crashed. He wanted to run and see the wreckage as well, but his father wouldn't let him. And it says Stevens himself never got to see the wreckage, but his father saw it the very next day. So there's at least, a couple witnesses that say they were there and it did in fact happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up on the aluminum a little bit. I can finish this off. The Washington Monument was capped with a 100-ounce, 2.83 kilograms, of an aluminum apex lightning rod, was placed on December 6, 1884. The Apex was the largest single piece of aluminum cast at that time. Can you imagine that? This is 6 pounds of aluminum, the largest piece of aluminum ever cast at that time, when aluminum commanded a price comparable to silver. 2 years later, so that would have been 86, a different processing system came into being, and that made the prices affordable for the public, and the price of aluminum plummeted. So aluminum would be known, but there probably wouldn't be a ton of it around in the community. But if somebody lifted it and it was light, there's a good chance after 10 years people had an opportunity to see aluminum at a better price than when it was comparable to silver. That's the end of the Washington Monument story.
Wow.
So aluminum at the time of that article would be a fairly topical item of interest. If, you know, 10 years after the price dropped, people would know about aluminum. It would be something that people had talked about because it was considered rare, and then now it was more inexpensive and more accessible. So that would be a good choice of a metal to have in a spaceship for aerodynamic purposes and lightweightness, but it would also be interesting because people would be tuned into aluminum.
That makes a lot of sense, Trey. It really does. And so we're getting about 20 minutes until the hour because we've got about 20 minutes left in our broadcast. What I'd like to do is I'd like to give each one of our co-hosts an opportunity to ask a question of John LeMay, because John, you're just a fund of information on this thing, and it's been grand having you here and really exploring this. And then I'm going to end up with a big question. So first of all, Todd, and then Dr. Trey, and then Kyler. So Todd, what is your question? What is your main question for John LeMay about the Aurora UFO crash?
All right. The one thing, and it probably is a bit more of an observation again, is that so much there doesn't seem to be a lot of the perception issues about what people believe saw or what happened for those that were around the event. We all know that you can have 10 people in a room looking at the picture of the Mona Lisa and give a written description of it. And when you review those written descriptions, you may not even know that it was a Mona Lisa in all cases that they gave you a written description of. So everybody has their own perception. I just think it's interesting that it's pretty, generally speaking, consistent. And, the windmill was across the board, and more than a few notes about the flower garden. What an odd detail. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Oh, I agree. The devil's always in the details, and it's those little odd things that always bolster it up. So I agree. The windmill, with the windmill, I don't know if it was like they threw the wreckage in the windmill or if the wreckage just happened to get in there and they couldn't get it out until all those years later. That might have been another possibility, too, as opposed to the town people throwing it in there. Or did it say they threw it in there? Because I've already forgotten, even though we just read the article.
Not the windmill itself, just that it was damaged in the incident. They really didn't talk about the aftermath on that. Anybody got anything different? Over. Yeah, it was just shipwreckage in the well as far as that part went, aside from what everybody, the odds and ends that were collected across board. All right, I'm done taking your time. Thanks, guys.
All right, Dr. Trey.
John LeMay, it's not really a question. It's more like an assignment. John, if you had a craft of some sort that crashes and it has a ton more of debris, you'd think that somebody would still have some chunks of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I, as a natural collector, would have taken a big chunk and held on to it. I wonder what's available today in the community as far as a chunk of the wreckage. And also, were there any photographs taken? You know, in 1897, you certainly had photography. You didn't have heavier than air aircraft in 1897, but you did have photography. Is there any evidence of any photographic evidence?
So not a Aurora, but there was at least one newspaper article about a man in Chicago, I think it was, who claimed that he photographed an airship. And, you know, newspapers in 1897 couldn't really reproduce photographs. So what they would do is they would just illustrate the photograph. They would say, here's an illustration of the photograph. But, yeah, so allegedly there is a period airship photograph, Chicago, you know, that same year, 1897, but it's lost. Nobody's ever found it. And in terms of Aurora, you know, you have to wonder if it's the same deal as with Roswell, you know, because after Roswell, the little ranching community north of Roswell called Corona, a lot of the ranchers had that debris blow onto their property and they'd collect it. And they said almost inevitably the military would always come knocking at their door and confiscate any of the wreckage that they found. So I think it's very well possible that the wreckage was confiscated from, you know, any Aurora residents that potentially picked it up, because NOAA and I have found airship stories from the past involving the Men in Black, of all things, believe it or not. And I think the earliest evidence or the earliest story we turned up of an airship crash cover-up was in Braxton County, West Virginia, same place where the Flatwoods Monster was seen in the 1950s. But in the 1920s, there was an airship crash there, and the Men in Black were actually seen in the area covering it up, allegedly. So it's quite possible that Aurora was covered up Roswell style, and we just don't really hear any stories about it.
Wow, now that is a piece of breaking news, actually. That's just, it's like, thanks for that. That's an incredible thing to say, because, yeah, I mean, what we think is that John Keel, in his book Visitors from Outer Space, better known as the Mothman Prophecies, John Keel seems to have been one of the first people to have detailed about the Men in Black. And the Men in Black seem to be quite prevalent in legends like this. And I'll just say legends, but we know that they're true stories. That's what I think.
But so, would there be would there be Men in Black in 1897? There's no heavier than air aircraft in 1897. The government wouldn't have an Air Force division that would go around scavenging up debris. So if they did scavenge it up, it would have been at a later date, which really would have been quite interesting, because then certainly town residents would know people came in, they were offering money for debris that was picked up, and maybe they scavenged it up in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s. Who knows? But that would have been in more recent memory than in 1897.
A very good point. Yet there are those of us, basically, I don't know if anybody in this group has ever read Visitors from Space by John Keel, which is made into the Mothman Prophecies movie. This was like the early 60s, and this is, by all accounts, the first recounting of the Men in Black. Now, and I think it might be, and I'll go ahead and put it on record, it might not be a bad thing to try to find more stories about the Men in Black, because there are people that say the Men in Black are aliens. And maybe they were right. We don't know, but you know what? At least we can, you know, and John LeMay, I'll ask you this. I mean, we can probably start looking for stories that might lend us to think that the Men in Black were around before the 60s. I mean, do you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we've talked about this on here before. And usually the Old West Men in Black sightings were always what you said, they were more along the lines of aliens themselves, as opposed to being men out to cover up, you know, the airships. But I think Noe and I, let me see here, the chapter, I think, directly following Aurora is about Men in Black and an airship. Let me see if I find that.
Yeah, the Men in Black weren't an event until, like, the 50s, if I recall, and I thought they all followed basically the form of the, what is it, the 12 or whatever they're called.
Yeah, in pop culture for sure. And, I mean, it's kind of like UFOs were around before there were UFOs. We just came up with the term UFO and flying saucer, you know, after the Kenneth Arnold sighting. But, yeah, lots of Men in Black sightings actually in the Old West in 1897 on April 20th. 1897, just a few days after Aurora, in Homan, Arkansas, there was an airship. They sighted an airship being piloted by men dressed in all black. But they weren't really out to cover anything up. They were just, you know, flying the airship. So it's interesting.
Just think. So in 1897, you could have had Men in Black going around slapping down conspiracy theories. Sorry, I couldn't resist with Will Smith and the
That took a minute.
Yeah, it wasn't my best, but it was what I could come up with at the moment.
I think that joke sank like a rock. Get it?
I'm just
kidding. Oh, the punishment just continues.
Well, I tell you what, Trey, we're trying to engineer. So Kyler and I are going to be in Marfa, Texas, and we're trying to engineer John LeMay coming from Roswell to Marfa, Texas. We are going to do a live Scarycast episode with you, John LeMay, and me and Kyler, and we're going to talk about this because we're going to get to the. John LeMay, are you okay? We're going to get to the bottom of all this. Is that okay?
I would love to. I'd love to get to the bottom of it.
I mean, does Aurora have a local history museum? On some little dusty shelf, there might be, you know, a chunk of metal. You're not the first one to investigate this, so it's probably not available or it would have been done. But it would be interesting to go to the local history museum. Maybe the county has a history museum and just see what they have on this.
Yeah, I don't think they do because I think somebody would have turned it up by now and made a big deal out of it.
I would think
sure.
so, too. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. All right, Kyler, not ignoring you. We got sidetracked here. What is your question for John LeMay to close this broadcast out?
Well, it's actually for both of you guys because John LeMay made a really good comment earlier about Proctor's kids. He said he had 5 kids. And I think it would be great to go, you know, try and track them down and hear their stories and see maybe if there's something that wasn't told or maybe they had something. So I was curious if you guys had any evidence or heard anything about them at all.
So I feel like I stumbled across that by accident. This is so weird. I think I was researching like a vampire's grave in Texas. And I kind of came across something that related to it, and it got me onto a different rabbit hole. Turns out, I mean, the vampire is not related to Judge Proctor, but that's what made me stumble across it. And I think because I was so preoccupied with the vampire's grave, I didn't really try to find Proctor's kids, but they're all listed. And I mean, hopefully they would have grandkids by now. It says there was an Edgar Proctor of Boyd, Texas. Let's see. Back then the problem is they wouldn't list the women's first names. They were Mrs. So-and-so. So I think a lot of the children were girls, you know, because they list Mrs. J.H. Chandlid. This is an interesting name. Orion Proctor. Orion, you know, is named after the stars. I think that's kind of interesting. So the one of the sons' name was Orion.
That raises an eyebrow.
Yeah. So it would be interesting to know if Orion was born before or after the crash. If he was born before, that would show that the judge had a preoccupation perhaps with the stars. But if he was born mm-hmm. after, it would almost seem to bolster Aurora's credibility.
Hmm. Yes, it would.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, John LeMay, thank you for those observations. And we have totally enjoyed talking with you about the Aurora crash. And I think what I personally like more than anything else is that we have more questions than answers. And we're mm-hmm. going to be going down there to Aurora, Texas, a little bit later this year, and we're going to find some answers, and we're going to talk to you. So the quest for Aurora, Texas information continues. And I hope you like it.
I'm very excited for that.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, thanks a lot. I want to say thank you very much to our co-hosts tonight, Todd Saxon of Pop Culture Stars, Dr. Trey Dunaway, the Surgeon General of Scarycast, and Kyler Smith, who is our new and very up-and-coming guy. He's asked great questions. And John LeMay, we're so glad that you were with us to celebrate the 125th anniversary of the Aurora UFO crash. So now we'll see you the first Monday of May, and we'll talk about more paranormal stuff on Scarycast. We just produced the Georgia Bigfoot Conference. It was an absolute smashing success. It was a lot of fun. And again, I want to thank our co-hosts, and I want to especially thank John LeMay. It has been wonderful having you here. So we're going to sign off. And everybody, just keep checking back on Scarycast. We'll have more information on Aurora, which Dr. John believes is the most exciting UFO crash. I'll just go ahead and say it. I think it's the most exciting UFO crash in history. As much as we love Roswell, I think Aurora has something that nothing else has. So we'll be reporting more about it. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time. Actually, we'll see you tomorrow night because we have our guest Mark Sargent of the Flat Earth Society. We love Mark Sargent. He's great. He's a lot of fun to have on. So we'll see you tomorrow night, April 18th, on Scarycast. We'll see you. Goodbye, guys.
Good night.
Good night. Bye, y'all.
Hey, John, in the group text, I dropped.